Welcome to The Green Urbanist, the urbanism and sustainability podcast. I'm Ross. Today's episode is about zero carbon, making sense of the confusing and conflicting arguments around the concept and asking, what does a zero carbon world look like and what role do urbanists have in achieving this? Last year, the UK government signed into law that it would reduce its greenhouse gas emissions to zero by 2050. Yet for many people, this is not soon enough. And the recent major demonstrations by climate activists around the world has brought zero carbon into the media spotlight. The question is, what does zero carbon really mean, and how do we get there? There are many different ideas about this. Some people think we can continue business as usual and invent our way out of the problem. Some people think that the push for economic growth is the problem, and we need a massive rollback of our modern carbon-intensive way of life. Because nobody has reached zero carbon before, there's no roadmap, no accepted way of achieving it. In fact, there is likely many different paths to zero carbon, and these would vary between each country and each organisation. What I would like to present today is just one scenario for the United Kingdom reaching zero carbon, put forward by the Centre for Alternative Technology in Wales, also known as CAT, in their report titled Zero Carbon Britain. This report takes a very balanced approach and comes up with a realistic solution for achieving this goal. Again, it is not the only way, but it has been really helpful in shaping my understanding of everything that needs to happen to reach net zero. And although the focus is on Britain, there are lessons in here for other countries too. You can read the full report at cat.org.uk. I have no affiliation with CAT, I'm just a fan. So I cover a lot of different topics in this episode in a very general way. The idea is to start with an overview to show you how the jigsaw pieces fit together. Then, in subsequent episodes, I will deep dive into specific topics to better understand their role. When we say zero carbon, what we really mean is no net release of greenhouse gas emissions into the atmosphere. But carbon dioxide is kind of the big one, so we tend to translate other greenhouse gases into CO2 equivalent. Just so we can talk about everything at once, so I will be using the phrase zero carbon or net zero or carbon neutral, but this also encapsulates all the other nasty gases too. Remember that we're talking about net zero carbon, so it's not about never releasing any carbon into the atmosphere. It means that if you do release some, you need to capture it so that the end result is zero. We also have to understand that ending carbon emissions is just one element of fixing our problems. It doesn't necessarily deal with things like plastic waste in the ocean, the extinction of animal species, or the quality of our environments, both urban and rural. However, the challenge of reaching zero carbon is also an opportunity to solve many of our other problems, and I will touch on some of these synergies throughout the podcast. Okay, let's move on to the main event. What does this Zero Carbon Britain study propose? The study sets itself rules to follow, which shape the outcomes. The key ones to remember are to only use technology that is available now and currently in use, or that has been demonstrated to work. Supply our energy with 100% renewable technology with no nuclear component. This is because nuclear energy production produces waste, and that waste needs to be stored safely for thousands of years to come. And lastly, rule out geoengineering options that are dangerous or have not been proven to work. So that does leave us with the old-fashioned methods of planting forests and some newer proven methods of carbon capture and storage. Okay, so we've laid the ground rules. The study also has a set of aims, which basically ensures that life can continue in a fairly normal way, albeit with some changes, under a zero carbon scenario. These are: make sure energy supply meets energy demand at all times. This is one of the big problems of renewables. If the wind isn't blowing or the sun isn't shining, then there's no energy. Well, we have to figure out a way of making that work. Only rely on energy we produce in the UK, so no buying energy in from elsewhere. Ensure that the food we produce feeds the population sufficiently and healthily, and we'll talk about agriculture and diet later on. And lastly, must not reduce the areas for wildlife and conservation. So, actually, the solution for achieving net zero in the UK, as put forward in this report, is relatively simple. There are three stages. One, power down, which means reduce energy use. Two, power up, which means switch to renewables. And three, land use change. I'm going to present a simplified version and focus on the aspects that urbanists and designers will be most interested in. So, stage one, power down. By reducing our use of energy and using energy more efficiently, we can reduce the UK's energy use by 60% overall, And that makes it much easier to provide that energy in the form of renewables. So that's why this is the first step. The two big ones we can go after are energy associated with transport and with buildings. Transport is 40% of UK energy use, and fully half of that is for road transport, with aviation and freight being the other two big contributors. In reducing these emissions, there is a behaviour change element and a technological element. The behaviour change element is about facilitating and encouraging people to travel less, for instance by working from home and conducting more communication by phone and video rather than in person. We can also get more people walking, cycling and taking public transport by improving the facilities and infrastructure for these things. The report also promotes the need for carpooling to reduce the total number of cars on the road. So as urbanists, we need to push for the principles of good urbanism, compact cities with friendly streets that people want to walk and cycle on, and reliable, enjoyable public transport. There is likely a carrot and stick element to this, for instance, through congestion charging or parking levies to discourage people from driving. Now, the assumptions behind how much behaviour change you can get are actually really sensible. The report assumes that the distance travelled per person reduces by 13%. Public transport use increases by 14%, car travel reduces by about 20%. There's nothing hugely drastic here. It's totally within the realms of possibility to achieve this with concerted effort over the next 10 years. The technological side of this is the shift to all vehicles being electric. Now, this is going to happen anyway. It's written into law in many countries now that at a certain time, non-electric vehicles can no longer be sold. So it's really just a question of when. The other big challenge, however, is aviation, because planes not only run on fossil fuels, but they burn them high in the atmosphere, where the effects are even worse. There doesn't seem to be any viable electric planes on the horizon, so the solution here is to switch to using biofuel and synthetic fuel, which can be produced in a carbon-neutral way. I'll discuss this more in the next section on energy provision. The next big contributor that we can target is energy use in buildings. Energy used by buildings are 40% of the UK's energy use. In the UK and other northern countries, the big contributor to this is heating. In warmer climates, air conditioning would be the big energy suck. Other things like electronic devices and cooking are actually only a small percentage. So the big challenge of reducing energy use is that the vast majority of our building stock for the next many decades is already existing. What we have to do then is retrofit all existing buildings to improve insulation and reduce drafts. If you retrofit all existing buildings to a high standard, you can reduce heating demand by 50 to 60%. Now, of course, it would be hugely expensive and logistically mind-boggling. We're talking about a nationwide government subsidized scheme for systematically retrofitting every single house, office, and shop in the country. But the gains you get are that you have to invest less in renewable energies down the line because you just need less energy overall. And you also get a synergy here in that you increase the quality of life and health for vulnerable people who can't afford to heat their homes adequately. As for new buildings, the study proposes that they should be passive house as standard. Some people would think that is outrageous, but the fact is, if you build a poorly performing building now, then someone will just have to retrofit it in 10 years' time. So it pays to get ahead of this. If you do all of this, you can reduce energy demand for buildings by 47%. So those are the headlines from the power down element of this plan. There are lots more details in the report, including some stuff on industry that I haven't gotten into, but I'll let you dig into that if you want to. We're moving on to stage two of the Zero Carbon Britain strategy, and this is power up, which means switching to renewables. So in stage one, we drastically reduced the amount of energy we need, and now it's much more feasible to supply all that energy with renewables. Let's start by saying that 80% of the UK's greenhouse gas emissions are from burning fossil fuels. That puts in perspective how pressing it is to decarbonise the grid. Most of our energy mix is oil, natural gas, and a little bit of coal. Nuclear energy contributes a good chunk, but one of the rules of this study is to get rid of nuclear because it has its own set of problems. Currently, less than 5% of our energy mix is from wind, solar, and marine renewable energy sources. So what's the solution to this? Well, one of the issues with renewable energy is that it's inconsistent. When it's not windy or sunny, there are dips in the supply of energy. So the solution to this is diversification. You don't just rely on one type, you have to invest in a wide variety of generation methods. And this also includes things like burning biomass and geothermal energy, which is more reliable. Now, that being said, you have to play to your strengths. In the north and west of the UK and Ireland, we are blessed with high wind speeds. What's more, wind speeds are higher off the coast than they are on land. So offshore wind farms hold the most promise for this part of the world. If you're somewhere else in the world, like the Middle East or California, then probably solar energy would be the one you'd rely on. Remember also that one of the goals of the study is to make sure that energy demand is met at all times, so you don't have moments when you can't make a cup of tea because it's a calm, cloudy day. So bearing all that in mind, the energy mix proposed within this study is about 50% wind power, with the remainder made up of, you ready for this, wave and tidal, solar, geothermal, hydropower, ambient heat, and biomass. Of all of these, biomass is a really key one. Biomass is essentially just organic material like trees, which you can grow, chop down, store, and then burn for energy when you need it. Now, when it burns, it does release CO2, but it only releases the same amount of CO2 that it absorbed while it was growing. So technically, there's no additional emissions, and that's what I mean when I say net zero carbon. Biomass can also be used to create biofuels, which can be stored for later use or used in particular technologies that can't run on electricity. Then, on top of this, we need to deploy ways of storing energy for when demand is high but supply is low. There are lots of ways to do this, like batteries, heat storage tanks, storing biogas and synthetic gas. It's just another piece of the puzzle, and it may have some interesting impacts for urbanists if cities need to be retrofitted with this new kind of storage infrastructure. Okay, so we've cut our energy demand down, and now we're supplying all of that through renewables. That brings us up to a 90% reduction in our greenhouse gas emissions. The last 10% to get to true zero carbon is largely to do with how we manage our land on a macro scale, and that's why stage 3 is land use change. Let's look at the existing land cover in the UK. There are 66 million people on this little island, and it can feel very urbanised. However, only about 5% of the total land area is urban area. In fact, about 30% of all the land in the UK is grassland for livestock. About another 10 to 15% is arable land growing crops for us. And then the same amount of land, about 10 to 15%, is arable land growing crops to feed livestock. Now, you've probably heard that livestock contributes to greenhouse gas emissions through producing methane. And that's true. However, it's a relatively small percentage when you consider things like transport and heating buildings and all that we discussed earlier. However, if we want to get to net zero, this is a consideration we have to have. I think the bigger issue with livestock, and cows in particular, is just how much space they take up to produce essentially two products, meat and dairy. Calorie for calorie, it's very inefficient compared to growing crops, but it's tricky because actually grasslands tend to have very rich soils that act as carbon storage. So if you convert grassland to arable land, you just plough it up, then you release all that carbon into the atmosphere. Another issue is that the land cover in the UK has become so monocultural that we've seen huge losses in habitat and biodiversity. Now, as biodiversity reduces, the productivity of agricultural land reduces too. The whole system is connected. So we need to be expanding the amount of unmanaged land for wildlife and biodiversity, not just because it's a good thing to do in and of itself, but it also increases our own food security. Another issue is that as part of our renewable energy strategy, we want to grow biomass. We need to find land to do that. And something else we want to do is to plant trees and restore peatlands to sequester carbon, to offset some of the emissions we'll still have to get us to net zero. So, taking all that into account, it's clear that we need to make some room for these necessary things. And the thing that's taking up so much space on the island of Britain is land for livestock. So what the study calculates is that we should reduce the land for livestock by 75% and convert that to land for growing biomass, for planting forests, restoring peatland for carbon capture, and rewilding some land for the purpose of biodiversity. Remember earlier I said that we use as much cropland to grow feed for livestock as we do to grow crops for ourselves? Well, if there's less livestock, then there's also less need to grow food for livestock. So we can make use of some of that land, a lot of that land, to grow food for us, making the UK more self-reliant when it comes to food and reducing these import things like fruit and vegetables, which have a large carbon footprint. Now, reducing our production of meat and dairy to a quarter of what it is obviously has huge implications for our diets and our culture and raises questions around equality and health. I could talk about this for hours, but instead I'll dedicate a whole episode to this, so keep an eye out for that. By making these land use changes, we have reduced emissions relating to agriculture, we've created space for growing biomass for energy, and we've increased our land for natural carbon capture. After all that, we are now officially at net zero carbon. If you're feeling bowled over about how much work is needed and how expensive all this will be to achieve, then I'd just like to leave you with a quote from Simon Wren-Lewis, who is an Oxford economist. "No one in 100 years' time who suffers the catastrophic and irreversible impact of climate change is going to console themselves that at least they did not increase the national debt. Humanity will not come to an end if we double debt to GDP ratios, but it could if we fail to combat climate change." That's it for this episode. If you enjoyed it and you want to read the whole report, you can follow the link in the show notes. As I said, I had nothing to do with the research and I have no affiliation with the authors, but I think it's a fantastic piece of work and I want to share it with you. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe to the podcast wherever you're listening. Follow us on Twitter at GreenUrbanPod and Instagram at GreenUrbanistPod, where you'll find additional content and news. Thanks.